This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for December 10th, 2013. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. I'm Drew Messenger-Michaels.
I'm Lucio Valentino.
And as promised, we are going to continue our discussion from last time. We were talking about SteamOS and the implications thereof, and we had gotten to the snarling, multi-headed Hydra behemoth that is DRM. So this is a topic that Lucio and I are both pretty passionate about, so we're going to try and keep it sane by framing it this way. I got two questions that I want to ask. The first one is this. It's as much an anecdote as a question, but here it is. I like DRM-free games, on principle. You know, I like when games don't require me to activate them or phone home or whatever. I love that the Humble Indie Bundle gives me executables. I love that, you know, good old games or GOG.com, as they're called now, is DRM-free. But when I buy the Humble Indie Bundle and I get a DRM-free version of the game and I also get a Steam code, I always just plug in the Steam code and download the Steam version every single time. And it gets me thinking that Steam has for games... Well, before I say that, Lucio, are you the same? Do you
yeah,
also do that?
I know that it comes with the executables. Partly it's just OCD because so much of my library is in Steam. But yeah, I think it's what you're about to say, which is that I have no problem registering up with Steam.
Exactly. So Steam is DRM. Steam is limiting. Steam takes away some of our freedom. With DRM-free executable, I could be playing it, and I could have sent you a copy, and you could be playing it at the same time. If it's a multiplayer game and the servers are something we can run or whatever, we could even play it together. Steam doesn't let you do that, but it gives you some things in return. It lets you download, install, uninstall, and reinstall games on a whim. It keeps all of your stuff together. Updates are completely automatic. There's the social aspects of it. There's trading cards. Steam trading cards. There's all
Steam
of that.
Trading cards?
Steam trading cards and badges. All of that stuff. I mean, you know, I make fun of Steam trading cards, but I blogged about this. I've gotten $136 worth of free games just by selling Steam trading cards now. Thank you. I hate myself. So I'm not knocking that. I mean, like, Valve's experiments are great. But are we okay with the fact that we've now inured ourselves to DRM? Are we happy with what Valve has done? Because they've been responsible with their power so far, but it is legitimately a lot of power for one company to hold, to have convinced us all, even people as generally anti-DRM as you and I, that that's okay. What do you think? Are you okay with it?
You know, I'm of two minds. One, I'm just, you know, I don't like DRM. I don't like what it implies. I understand why it's sort of reared its head in the wake of the sort of fear that people will lose control of their property, ideas, value, whatever you want to call it. But I think ultimately it just does more harm than good, because what it creates is this environment of treating your consumer like a criminal. I mean, you know, everyone said it who has looked into the subject. I mean, we're not saying anything new on that regard. But I think the reason it works for Steam is because, or for Valve, I should say, is because, as you say, they've wielded their power with a lot of responsibility, and they definitely do not treat their consumer base like criminals, like idiots. There are checks. I mean, I think I don't think Steam allows you to kind of go around or circumvent the license checks when you get a game. Like if you were to try and install something through Steam, or if you wanted to play, like, let's say a pirated copy of Left 4 Dead with your friends, I don't think you could through Steam.
They're downright vicious about you trying to play an online pirated version. The Valve anti-cheat thing is pretty intense.
Oh, tell me about that, because I don't even know about
that. So Valve Anti-Cheat is a mostly automated service that tries to make sure people aren't botting or cheating in multiplayer Valve games. I work with a guy who is so good at Counter-Strike that he can't play Counter-Strike anymore, except over a LAN, because the thing thinks he's a bot. So it's kind of, you know, and he's like appealed to Valve about that.
Is this the original mod, or is this a
this
Go?
Is, that's a good question. I think he's talking the original mod. I know he's been playing Go, but his account hasn't been banned, so I'm assuming he's okay with that. Maybe they've refined the algorithm. But Valve Anti-Cheat is this thing where they're trying to make sure people play fair. It's like it you know, it actually does what Blizzard said they were trying to do with the Diablo 3 always on DRM, you know. So that's what that is.
Okay. And I think that, you know, it's one of those things. I look at it as what good democracy should be, a good republic should be, in that, you know, we give them our money and we are willing to take these little things because ultimately they represent us pretty well, or at least, you know, the kind of business I would like to see, you know, in video games, because they offer, you know, great deals. Like, you know, I think they sort of understand that games shouldn't be priced the way they are. And so, you know, the sales that they have, I'm assuming with the cooperation of the developers or of the companies that own the licenses.
There've been a few weird corner cases where they were like, oh, we're on a Steam sale. That's interesting. But I think generally the developer is pretty involved and also pretty happy with the result.
Yeah. You know, I think the fact that they do that, see, cause to me it's less of, I think it's, I sort of tend to look at the Steam sales as sort of an opposite scenario whereby every day things are just ludicrously overpriced and it's less of a sale and more of like a reasonable price that they have.
Yeah, so this is, and Valve has talked about this, or Gabe Newell has, you know, speaking for Valve, because he's the metonym for all of Valve. He has said that he thinks game pricing is broken, and I would pretty, especially in the AAA space, that's undeniably true.
Is absolutely true.
This incredible value on novelty. Like, why is a game $60 at launch and then $20 3 months later? What is three times more valuable about a game that just came out? It's very, very strange. Our mutual friend Jay refers to me waiting for games to get cheaper as living in the past. He thinks that you can't do that. Like, he sort of buys into the idea that what's new is what you should be playing, and that makes sense because he's in tech and he's interested in like the latest and greatest, and that's all fine, but I don't know. I mean, like indie games have that problem to a lesser degree because, you know, an indie game tends to be $20 when it comes out and then $20 forever, except when it's on Steam sale.
Well, I'm gonna just take a minute to interject here real quick. I just wanted to just as a case in point. So, Call of Duty: Modern Warfare 3 came out in 2011. So that was 2 years ago. And the Call of Duty Ghosts, which sort of, you know, as far as a lot of these developers are concerned, like replaces it, just came out a few days ago. Call of Duty: Modern Warfare 3 is currently priced at $40. Each of the downloadable content packs is $15. So if you wanted to buy this game in its entirety on Steam right now, you would be paying $120 for Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. That's with all the DLC included. And that's a game that came out 2 years ago and was just supplanted by Call of Duty Ghosts.
So that's a good point, right? that's messed up and broken. And out of control DLC is a problem that is not necessarily limited to the AAA space. Dungeon Defenders had a ludicrous number of DLCs by the end there. I resisted getting Crusader Kings 2, which is a wonderful game by Paradox, which is not really a AAA developer, but also not completely indie either, which you might call AA, I guess. But that game is amazing, but I resisted getting it because I wanted to get the whole game. I didn't want to get this tiny piece of it and then have to get the piecemeal DLC later. Because there's that infuriating thing where, like, for example, I bought Borderlands 2, and I didn't buy the season pass or whatever. Season passes or something else we can talk about.
You bought Borderlands 2 when it was new?
When it was new-ish. I think, like, the first time there was a sale, I grabbed it, or grabbed a 4-pack with some people or whatever.
Yeah.
And there will never be a scenario where getting the DLC I don't have is less expensive than it would be to just buy the Game of the Year edition or whatever and get everything. So I'm never going to buy the DLC because that's insulting. You know what I mean? Why? Like, I'm basically being, because I don't get another copy of the base game to give away. That's just that money is lost.
I'm the exact same way. I mean, when Arkham Origins, I think, just came out, I remember thinking, oh, well, as soon as this game wins some awards, and I guess a year from now I'll be buying it when it's $10 and I can get everything that's on there.
That's the thing. I rented Bioshock Infinite right when it came out, and I rented it and played through it on Xbox, but I'm not going to buy it until all the DLC is included, if the DLC even turns out to be worth it, which no one knows. But
yeah.
You were saying that?
No, I was going to say, and it's not necessarily to say that I dislike the developers or, you know, but I think it's unfortunate because they're sort of the, I guess you could say, caught in the crossfire, because obviously they need the money to survive. I mean, I don't know how much money they need. I don't know how these figures are decided upon. You know, and I want to support them, but at the same time, you know, you're supporting two sides. You're supporting the executives, the ones who were, I guess, putting the price, you know, the sticker on it. Because whatever they can get away with, they'll get away with. That's why games are $60 at launch, and that's why, you know, a digital copy where all they have to do is send you data over your broadband that you're paying for is $60.
There's no box.
So it's really hard to make those kinds of, you know, decisions, because we really do. We vote with our wallet, and sometimes what you're saying with your wallet can be saying two completely different things. That was sort of my hang-up with Bioshock Infinite, like you were just saying, before I knew that I wouldn't enjoy it, back when I thought I would positively enjoy it.
Whether the game comes out good is a related, but not, you know, it's not the same issue. It's, yeah.
Exactly. But yeah. They had Bioshock, and they had Bioshock 2 in the can, and they were both really good games, and I really enjoyed them, so I felt like it was a confident purchase. But to pay $60 at launch day, I felt like I would be saying, yeah, I'm totally okay with you overpricing games. And I wasn't okay with that. As much as I love the developers, I wanted to say, I remember having this conversation with you, and I said, I wish there was a way I could say, yeah, I will totally pay on day one so that you guys can recoup whatever it is that you need to keep making games of this caliber, well, what I thought would be this caliber. but I don't want to also say to the people above you who are only concerned about the bottom line dollar, yeah, I'm totally cool with that. Go nuts. Why aren't you charging $70 for this game?
I'd pay $90 to play the beta, you know, which is a Kickstarter thing. And that's, again, actually more in the indie space, which is weird. The paying more for a beta is weird to me, because, like, to me, it should always be the Minecraft model or the Cube World model, where you pay less to get in earlier and you're helping fund development. Mm. And that's because you're an early adopter. You know, that makes more sense to me, or the Steam early access thing. Some games do that in that way.
But going back to why we're okay with DRM with Steam, the reason we're okay with that is because that's good faith in the consumer. That's treating the person who wants your product like, yeah, you know, you're an asset. You're as much a part of this as we are. Without you, we don't exist.
Totally, totally. Well, and there's two aspects to the overpricing of games. One is that AAA games are really fucking expensive to make. Yeah, you know, you have to have these massive teams and graphics tech pushing to the upper limits of what's possible. The other thing, though, is, as you said, unrealistic expectations on the executive boardroom, you know, Mr. Businessman cigar chomping side of things, where a game can sell it can sell 5 million copies and still be a failure. See, yeah, yeah. There's, I don't know, that's less like Land Baron and more, you know, Chicago Gangster, but we'll take it. That's, you know, well I guess, yeah. I, you know, you're right, though. It feels like Chicago Gangsters because you feel like you're getting shook down, you know?
Yeah.
especially with DRM, especially with, you know, there have been more egregious versions than others. Again, we brought up Mass Effect 3 last time, but the original ending did include a thing where right after you saw the big climax, it said, congratulations, buy some DLC. Or there was a...
Really?
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people complain about Mass Effect 3, but they were mostly disenchanted with the ending, and no one actually... You're the first person to mention that they did something. So that you're saying at the end of this whole of three games, where you've been leading up to this ending, bad or not, you know, this is the ending you were working towards, you spent hours, you're saying as soon as it was over, they hit you with buy DLC.
There's this little pop-up message.
Was that even before the credits roll?
No, it was after the credits, when it bumps you back into the main menu so you can keep playing. When we talked last time about how games tend to put you right before the point of no return so you can play around. Before it does that, this little message pops up that says, you know, Shepherd's Adventures can continue with this and that pack.
And is it really phrase it like that?
One of the things they changed when they changed
the
ending.
Like a 1930s serial novel?
Pretty much. Yeah. All to today. One of the things they changed when they changed the ending is that instead it says, you know, you've made Shepard a legend. Thank you for playing the Mass Effect games. It was a much classier message, you know, so that's one of the ways in which the ending they changed was inarguably better. But I think people's negative reaction to the ending had more to do with that particular tasteless gut punch than they realized. You know, like, you're right, I don't hear people talk about it that much, but that's really crass. Like, that's...
Yeah.
And there was and BioWare's been bad about that in the past. There was, I think it was the first Dragon Age game where there's a character who's dying, And he basically says, you can save me if you buy this DLC pack for $5.
Really?
Like, yeah, it was really...
I never heard anyone complain about that. Because was Dragon Age made under EA? That's what I can't remember.
Good question. I believe the EA thing happened for Mass Effect 2. So the first Dragon Age game would have been just before that. I'd have to check this whole dramatic timeline. It was when those wheels were beginning to turn, I guess.
Okay, because I would hate to think that BioWare was sort of in on this thing from the beginning, if it was injected into Dragon Age before, you know. But that's just me wanting to make EA worse than they are. I'll freely admit that bias.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people want it to be that EA is the devil and BioWare are these poor souls who were corrupted. And it's you know, I mean, that's certainly, I'm not defending EA, but it's maybe not quite as simple as all that.
Yeah.
I think BioWare don't really, like, they overthink certain things and they underthink others. That's the main thing about BioWare, you know?
Yeah.
So let's go back real quick to voting with your wallet, because I wanted to talk about this. I'm glad you brought it up. Did I interrupt you, by the way? Were you about to say
something? No, not at all. No.
Cool. So, voting with your wallet. The most complicated example that I've run into of this recently was Rayman Legends. So Rayman Legends is a sequel. First of all, I'm supporting sequels, so let's add this to the list. To a game I really liked. Okay, let's add that to the list. Rayman Origins was really, really good. It's a game with co-op, so I want to support that. But the co-op doesn't go online, which is kind of silly for a big budget game, so I don't want to support that.
A lot of games have been doing that.
It's weird. It's weird. And
Spelunky still doesn't have online co-op.
It does not. And I get that it's fun on the couch, but it's fun offline isn't a reason not to have online. That would be like saying, well, your microwave is best if it goes for 1 minute, so it shouldn't get to go for 10. Like, it doesn't really make any sense. These pants are good if you wear them to... I don't know, anyway. I'll stop straining the metaphor. But okay, so I'm supporting co-op, but also only offline co-op. I'm supporting that. So that game did launch. Its digital version was $20 cheaper. It was only $40 at launch. So $40 at launch, which I want to support. But $40 is still a lot, so I'm supporting that. The game came out on PC, which is great, but it came out on PC because it was going to be a Wii U exclusive, and then they delayed it. And the developers didn't really like that, and because the game was done, and they wanted it to come out, so I'm supporting that. So all of that to say, what message am I sending by buying Rayman Legends, you know? And then I guess pre-orders, right? Like, pre-orders are kind of intrinsically messed up. That's why we were talking about swelling budgets and stuff. You know, in Hollywood, budgets swelled to the point where Hollywood started losing money, and that's when they kind of, that chase into them. That can't happen with games, because they make their money back on pre-orders. So I'm supporting that, but I'm supporting a developer I like. It becomes this giant tangled mess of what it is you're voting for with your wallet. You know, you're just checking one box, and then that does all kinds of things. It's complicated.
To say the least. I mean, that was why I had the whole issue with BioShock Infinite. It was just... You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're supporting a really audacious, crazy thing being made in the AAA space, but... I mean, we couldn't have known then how safe it was going to be in a bunch of ways.
Yeah, that was
what we could know
would have been an easier decision to make.
Right, exactly. What we could have known though, and what we did know, and what we talked about at the time, I remember you and I, was that the season pass thing is kind of messed up.
Yeah, and season passes. I mean, I'm trying to understand how they work, just because I feel like intrinsically they're just kind of messed up, but I feel like at the same time. I don't know, maybe you can correct me, but they're not always bad. So, for example, I think the most recent example is The Wolf Among Us,
mm-hmm.
Which we recently got. And I think this – correct me if I'm wrong, but with The Walking Dead and with The Wolf Among Us, isn't the season pass just – is it just equal to what you would pay if you were buying them anyway, or is it a little more?
It's usually slightly cheaper than just buying each episode individually.
And I mean – So that sort of goes hand in hand with what you were talking about, like pre-order. Like, do you feel like something like that is sort of bad? Because, I mean, ultimately, I just having played the first chapter, I'm pretty sure I'm going to buy the next four. In that kind of a situation, it's hard for me to imagine that I wouldn't do that anyway.
Yeah, but... well, that's a little different, I guess, because with Telltale's games, they're episodic, right? What you're getting is the games, and you're just paying... either the same or a little bit less to just get them as they come out. You know what I mean?
Because I want to say with The Walking Dead, as I recall, wasn't it? It was $5 each episode, and then when they were all out, the game just cost $25. And that, I mean, a model like that kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah, totally. You know, and I think, it's not... in fact, on the Xbox, episode one was eventually free. Which is a little weird for people who were early adopters. Again, you know, like, then maybe, like, if they were really being magnanimous, then they could have said, and if you own episodes 1 through 4, 5 will be free, or whatever, you know, whatever weird thing. But yeah, you're right. You're not paying more for that. And you're not paying more for... Here's the other thing about that. With the Telltale-style season passes, you know what you're getting. You're getting... I mean, you don't know what the content's going to be, but you know I'm getting 4 more episodes of this game. With the BioShock Infinite style of season passes, or the Borderlands 2 one, to use another example, it just says, we're going to give you 4 things. You don't know what they are. You don't know if they're multiplayer-focused or single-player-focused.
Yeah, that's the weird thing to me, because... Yeah. I mean, it's funny now because I remember at the time I had said, well, you know, if BioShock Infinity, if the season pass includes more story stuff, you know, I would want to pay for that. But at the same time, why isn't it in there? I mean, there was a lot of back and forth. But, you know, if you were to ask me now, I'd be like, yeah, if it's more story stuff, definitely no. An extra no.
Yeah, absolutely. And emphatically no. Because it's by definition, it's outside of the game that they made. And it's, I get the DLC exists for a reason, which is that, you know, with AAA games, there's this whole testing and production, whatever period, where the developers aren't doing anything, but they've got to be doing something, and they probably can't start on the next game, so they'll make something that then becomes DLC, sometimes the dreaded day one DLC, right? Yeah. But I think with BioShock Infinite, that maybe, that must have been the case. They must have been working on Burial at Sea, or at least talking about it at that stage. But
I mean, DLC is one of those funny things, because I feel like at its core, there's... I'm trying to think of like how to say this. I feel like at its core, DLC just shouldn't exist. I mean, when you get down to it, a really good, like kind of what we were talking about with Valve, a really good business model should be, you know, this customer paid for this game. You know, we made enough, you know, we didn't, like, ideally, they didn't spend ludicrous amounts of money on making the game that they had to recoup. So, you know, let's say they made a really good profit and then some, and then it's, you know, the decision should be, well, then let's give them a little bit more because they enjoyed this, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's the ideal. I'm not saying that'll necessarily happen. Short of that, the only scenario I can imagine where DLC feels sort of applicable is, for me personally, is like fighting games. Like, you remember back when cartridges were a thing? It's sort of funny to think about now, because you were basically paying the same price for a game that just had some tweaks and mods. So, like, buying Street Fighter 2, and then you buy Super Street Fighter 2, then you buy Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo, then you buy Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo Champions Edition, then you buy Super Street Fighter 2 Champions Edition Hyper HD Remix, which is a real thing, by the way. I just have to put that out there.
Well, it's not weird, because number one, Madden exists, and number two, Capcom is still doing that. Capcom is, in fact, like, there's... Yeah.
No, I'm not saying it's weird that it exists, but I'm saying that I feel like it would be relevant in that situation if it was more like, let's say Capcom does a completely new Street Fighter game, mm-hmm. and they did it with 20 characters and it was successful. And then it's like, well, we want to do another game and tweak it. But, at, you know, but then package everything together. It's like, you know, maybe something like pay $5 and here's these extra characters and the new version. And, you know, but DLC should not be this, I don't feel like, it should be this weird microtransaction thing where it's like, you're paying for this character, then you're paying for this character's extra costumes, then you're paying for this, you know, batch of music tracks that you can also, you know, like, I feel like the more you expand it, the less relevant it becomes.
It should be used responsibly, and it shouldn't, I think it gets a little creepy also when, as you sort of allude to, when it mirrors social game or free-to-play mechanics in a game you've paid for. That's not very cool.
Did you see that Angry Birds Star Wars is $40 on Xbox Live?
Is that a joke?
No, that's a real thing.
Isn't that like a $5 phone?
Yes, it
game?
Is. And I thought it was a joke too, but I went into the marketplace last night because I was curious and I looked at Arcade, and Angry Birds Star Wars is $40.
Is it like one of those deals like Fruit Ninja Connect where they've like substantially redone the game, or like, but even Fruit Ninja Connect is retail price. That's crazy.
I have no idea, but it's $40.
I don't even know what to say about that.
I was just adding that in there because it felt relevant.
It is totally relevant. Let's just leave that fact on the floor though. Let's just leave it where it sits. So DLC leads into an interesting thing, because that's something else that Steam kind of offers, is keeping all your DLC together, making it very visually obvious what DLC exists for a game and what you don't have, and that could be part of your purchasing decision, like I was saying with Crusader Kings. I can see the history of updates, so I know sometimes I'll buy DLC, you know, meaningful or not, if the developer has given me stuff for free, like the Sanctum games. They always release new maps or classes or whatever for free, and then they'll release packs or paid DLC, so I'm like, yeah, totally, you've given me cool stuff, good faith, I'll buy something else, right? So all those decisions are a lot easier on Steam. That brings us back to kind of the topic of DRM generally. And I want to ask you this, and I think it'll be a pretty quick topic, because I think I know the answer, but... Steam, I think we agree, solves a lot of these problems, or at least mitigates them, and it makes us feel okay about having our games in a DRM-laden format. You and I are both guys who our music collection is just a bunch of DRM-free files, and I think we're pretty militant about that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you conceive of a Steam-like service that would offer some kind of advantage, I'm not sure what that would be, that would make you okay with having your music collection tied to some form of DRM?
I think this is what makes it tricky. I actually have a really good, I hope I have a really good response for you. Valve came out with Half-Life, I think, God, what year was that? Was that like 96 or 97? I don't even
know. I thought it was 98, now. But I'd have to check.
It might
have
been even later, yeah, 98. Anyway, the point is that Valve, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Valve and has been around longer than DRM has kind of been a thing. I don't remember when DRM started kind of coming to the forefront, but I want to say that it was kind of around the turn of the century, like 2000-ish.
There's been DRM forever. There were like weird decoder things on old games where you had to like ciphers and stuff, but it became something everyone expected probably around that time.
Yeah. Well, okay, then I'll put it in this context. Within my own personal scope, Valve has always been around. Steam has always been around as long as I've had to deal with DRM. And in that respect,
yeah.
It's always sort of, I guess you could say, circumvented the idea of DRM. Like, I've been okay with it because they've handled it in a good way, like we've been talking about. There's almost no business model that's comparable in the music world. And there's so much history of this weird temper tantrum backlash, this weird idea that these are the people giving us our money. Oh, we should prosecute them as harshly as we can and, you know, set an example and so that other people will never, you know, it's that sort of tyrannical context that we have for music. It's hard for me to imagine moving forward. Now, if the minute that Napster went online, someone had said, hey, this is illegal, we should find some legal way to do this because this is a great idea for people to get music, and something like that existed, I could probably buy into it. But now, unless it's maybe like some independent label that has several bands that I like and, you know, the bands are kind of on board, and I can't imagine a situation where it wouldn't feel like, oh, hey, remember all that stuff we didn't do? Check this out. We didn't remember that didn't happen. Just forget that. We're cool. We get it now. You guys were right. Let's give us money and you can just, you know, cause it, I mean, it's interesting, too, because I feel like a lot of people are saying that the music industry and the film industry as well should embrace better models. I think Netflix is sort of able to do that a little bit. I think I saw some little headline recently that said they're trying to push for streaming of films something like 90 days after they come out in theaters or something like that.
That would be incredible. I would use that. Yeah.
I mean, they could even, you know, boost their membership an extra $5 or, you know, include that as an additional package. Like, hey, if you want to, you know, see films 90 days out, you know, just, you could pay this little bit of extra. And as long as it's not outrageous, you know, it's still a great idea.
They could call it the Blockbuster package to really twist.
Yeah. Or something, you know, like, and so there's that. But I mean, if you're talking specifically about music, that's really hard because there's so much bad blood. And I think the closest that I've seen to an okay business model is like maybe I just forgot what it's called. I want to say Slacker Radio, but it's the one that came before Pandora. Maybe Pandora Radio, where I think if you pay, I don't know, I've never looked into what a membership costs, but it lets you play everything by an artist. It lets you basically play anything streaming.
Yep.
But that's still not the same as having, you know, the ability to just put stuff onto whatever you want. So I guess the long answer is I can't personally conceive of one.
Yep.
I don't know if that's because I don't have the mind to think of something that would be that, you know, cool and creative, but it's really hard. I can't imagine any situation like that now where I think the closest that someone could get, the closest they could get is not maybe a model, but if they just took away DRM and were like, okay, you know what? Pay $15 for the album. We're done. Just, you know, pay for it, support the artist, and we'll get off your case. That sort of a scenario, maybe then I would, you know, be more willing to, you know, just, yeah, like throw money at, you know, whatever. But that I can't.
Yeah, philosophically, what's interesting is Bandcamp does that, but then Bandcamp gives you a DRM-free file, right? So, like, there's no philosophical situation where you're doing that and paying, but then having to deal with DRM. So I guess there's a couple of aspects you brought up. You know, it's funny because you didn't come from the direction I was going to come from, which is Steam offers you stuff. What could a music service offer you? Right, it could offer you being able to download and re-download on a whim. But if you keep your files in MP3 format, it's not that big a storage burden. It's not the same as games. And it's also not the same as games in that I don't need to play Portal 2 in the car. You know, like, I don't need to have it anytime, anywhere, whereas with my music, I want to do that. But the argument you made is, I think, even more interesting, which is the genie is out of the bottle argument. We grew up sharing music and discovering music in a way that was illegal, but that no one has come up with a legal equivalent
even back
for.
Before MP3s. I mean, technically speaking, putting a CD onto a cassette tape, I think, was technically illegal, but people did it.
Yeah,
all
well,
the time.
It was illegal. They just didn't go after it very much, because when you're copying something to a cassette, every time you copy it, it degrades a little bit, and so it's not a scalable operation. But as soon as you have digital files, you can copy it a billion times, and there's no degradation whatsoever. So immediately that became a crisis, although it was a bit of a disingenuous crisis, because while Sony, for example, was saying, you know, this digital copying of music is killing us, they were also manufacturing and selling CD burners.
Yeah.
So... So there's that. But yeah, so I think I agree with you. I can't imagine. I think it's too... Well, my thought was, the genie is out of the bottle argument is I think, on the money. It's too late. Valve got in there and they created... And Steam, of course, had its problems initially. People hated it. But they sorted it out in such a way that everyone's basically... Not everyone, but a lot of people, enough people, are basically okay with it at this point. Interestingly, people who haven't heard of Steam still get mad about it sometimes. If you go to like an Amazon review of a game where Amazon just gives you a Steam code, every so often there'll be like a 1-star review that says like, you have to install this thing called Steam, and I don't even know what it is, and like, why do I have to do that? Like, it's interesting.
Really?
Yeah,
I was unaware of that.
I don't know if they're people who live in cabins in the woods and don't have social security numbers or who they are, but there are people.
And they somehow have access to a PC.
I don't know, man. They could be time travelers, but they've never heard of Steam. So there is still that, but I think there's a wide enough acceptance of Steam. I mean, I think Rock Paper Shotgun ran an article saying that like 0.1% of the world's entire population have Steam accounts or something. That may not be the exact number, but it's a lot of people.
That's a lot. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot when you put it in the number figures, but it's a lot of people.
But it's hundreds of millions. You know, that's the takeaway. So I think Steam has done something that it's too late to do for music. Books are an interesting kind of middle space, because I have books with DRM. I have Kindle books, because again, they can offer me something. Like, it'll remember, I can read it on my phone, or I can read it on my Kindle, or I can read it on my computer, and it remembers what page I'm on. That's neat. I do still keep a DRM stripped out copy on my computer, because I'm that guy, but because I don't trust companies to be curators of culture. But that's just my tinfoil hat. That's the fact is, the same way I like having the executable of the game, but I'm still going to use Steam. I like having the DRM free ebook, but I'm still going to go ahead and use the Kindle copy. Music, it's probably too late. I like Spotify a lot. I like the social aspects of it.
I'm not too familiar with Spotify. We could talk about it another time.
But, yeah. So, I mean, just the really quick version is that Spotify, like Pandora, offers a streaming service, but you can also sort of keep a collection of music and even download it to your device. But it does have to shake hands with home as far as DRM. And I think I looked up one time that, you know, to when you pay the premium, some of it goes to the artist, but you'd have to play the song something like 70 times to give them the equivalent of if you just bought it on iTunes once, you know? So it's like, it's not a whole lot of money. It's not a huge difference. And it is still pretty restrictive, you know?
And on the off chance that someone listening to this does not know, just in case, as far as I know, it still works. If you want to support a musician you like, it's actually more prudent to spend money going to a show and buying merchandise.
Yep, go to a show and
buy their music.
Exactly. And especially if they have some weird mixtape or whatever that they clearly burned on a CDR, buy that. And it's maybe not quite that simple, because, you know, if their record doesn't sell a lot, then their label won't fund them to make another record, you know? So you have to buy music.
No, it's certainly, but if you want to just support them directly,
absolutely.
I mean, whether that's whatever, you know, whether that's less or the bulk of the money they get, that's, and you know, always keep an eye to the ground for local artists too.
Absolutely. Supporting local is really, really good. And it's, I had one more thought and it ran away, because I was patting myself on the back for supporting local artists, which I do a fair bit up here in Chicago. I'm just so smug and self-satisfied. It's interesting.
George Clooney levels?
Not quite his acceptance speech. Yeah. The music thing is interesting. I think we've pretty much hit it. I think the record labels have assholed themselves out of the opportunity to create something like Steam. It may just, in fact, be too late, because I think our parents' generation might have bought into something like that, but I think we're too far gone. We're done.
Yeah. I think the best thing they could do would be to provide a this is just another random thought I had because we were talking about what you might pay for, is if they had some really, really absurd P2P, think like Oink or...
What.cd or Waffles.
Yeah, or some sort of system like that in place where you're paying for membership to that, but then it's mostly just hands-off run by the community, DRM free. That is probably, now that I think about it, I would pay for something like that. Because really, the best people, man, the best people doing, you know, work in, you know, music distribution are the people who are doing it illegally and out of passion.
So. Yep. What a nightmare and a license that would be. But it would work. Yeah. But I would pay for that if you could make it work. Totally. That is a form I would pay for. I mean, the thing, of course, is for it to be as good as a tracker is from a user point of view, it would have to be all you can eat, so to speak. So the temptation would, of course, be to pay for a month, download as much as you possibly could, and then never pay again. Right. That's a lot of people,
or even something like, because Oink was ratio based, you know,
that's true, that would, like,
where you can pay a higher amount to just download for free, or you can pay a discounted amount if you're contributing. I didn't even think of that. That's the sort of utopian thing that, like I said, that I would be totally down for and pay for and support, but
you're right. Yeah. Well, no, it's not, but it could. And like, I was thinking the biggest barrier is the all you can eat thing, but you're right that torrent trackers and some new trackers are not ratio based at all, but the old ones have an automatic check on you downloading everything at once, which is ratio. That makes all the sense in the world. All right.
So yeah, I think we both agree DRM bad, but in the right hands, you know, acceptable or passable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, Steam is proof positive that it can be, if not a good thing, then we can live with it, right? We can live with it, and we can embrace it. Not embrace it. I can't. Like, that's the thing. Like, Steam almost makes me feel like I like DRM, and that's not a good feeling. You know?
You love Big Brother.
Oh, I do.
Your eyes were clear.
Exactly. The long-awaited bullet is entering my brain. It's happening. Yeah. All right. Well, we got in the Orwell reference. I'm surprised it took us that long. That's cool. Let's maybe leave it there. Thanks for listening, everybody. You can subscribe to this podcast using good old-fashioned RSS if you're that kind of person. We're also on iTunes. We're on Stitcher, which if you haven't tried it, I like Stitcher. Are you familiar with Stitcher, Lucio?
I am not.
Stitcher is kind of cool. They're not, you know, we don't have sponsors or anything, so they're not giving me anything. I genuinely like it. It's this non-iTunes service that lets you subscribe to podcasts. You can sync them to your browser and your mobile device. So if I start listening to a podcast on my computer and then I want to pick up where I left off on my phone, I can just do that. That's kind of cool. So I like Stitcher. We're on there. Podbay is also just a giant aggregation service that has.
I think we also have ETAO carrier pigeons. If you just look up.
We do. Yeah. We're thinking that when the next season of Game of Thrones comes out, we'll switch to ravens as a cross promotional thing. But for now, they're pigeons.
Yeah.
Pigeons are more reliable. You can look that up. And
that's transcripted. The scrolls might be a little long, but.
Right. Exactly. We're not doing owls though. They know why. So you can also check out the blog at etao.wordpress.com. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Good night.
And good luck.